I am Hilda Gottlieb with Creating the Future, and I am here in Tucson, Arizona today. And let's all introduce ourselves and tell us what is going on that is awesome with you. Anybody wants to start?
So I'm Carl Wilding. I'm Creating the Future's European and UK representative. My awesome week this week is that I work for an organization called NCVO, the National Council for Voluntary Organizations, and we had our annual conference just in the last week, and we had some absolutely amazing speakers, people who sort of talked about things that hit you here right in the heart. It wasn't just about the stuff that was in the head. And one of the highlights was that the new chief exec of Oxfam GB, a guy called Danny Srizkandaraja, who's just new in post, talked very much about how he wants to take that international NGO forward. And he very much talked about language that I think Creating the Future people would recognize. And that he talked about new power and the power of social movements and how we got to not just keep power ourselves so that we can change the world, but we've got to give power away, and that's the only way that will change the world in the future. So that's my awesome.
That's an awesome, awesome.
Wonderful.
Who else? What's been going on in your world?
Well, mine is not as intellectually inspiring as Carl's, but Come Sunday, I will be on my way to Utah with my family for a week-long trip through the canyons, going through Bryce and Monument Valley and then up into Canyonlands and Arches. So getting very excited for that.
Oh, that is some of the most beautiful country.
Yeah, I keep telling my girls, I said, you have no idea what you're about to see. You've never seen anything like it.
Take number of cameras. Everybody's going to be wanting to take pictures at once from anything I've seen of that area. In pictures, I haven't been there.
Wow. Well, Jane, do you want to step in, say who you are and where you're beaming in from and what's been awesome with you?
I think everybody here knows me, Jane Garson from Toronto. And I think what's awesome with me is that as I'm moving towards, but not actually into retirement, deciding not to do any marketing, three of my most favorite prior clients have been in touch in the last couple of weeks with new work. That's just my ideal way of getting work is for somebody to say, hi, we love you, and can you come back? When three do that close together.
Oh, how awesome. That is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. It's good to have you here. How about you, Angie? What's been going on that's awesome with you?
Hello, everyone. I'm Angie Eikenberry in Omaha, Nebraska. And so a couple of awesomes. One is that I've been working with Hildy and talking with Hildy about collaborating with Creating the Future and our NOVA. And she's going to be coming to help us with our retreat in May, and I'm very excited for us to start some catalytic thinking through our NOVA, with our NOVA. And so that's a big deal, and I'm very excited about it. My own personal awesome is that it's sunny and 80 degrees today in Omaha, Nebraska. So I'm going to go outside after this meeting and stand in the sun for a while.
Beautiful, beautiful, unbelievable. You guys have had every kind of weather. It's definitely springtime in the Midwest.
The daffodils are blooming. Yay.
Oh, how nice, how nice. Dimitri.
A couple of awesomes. I'm Dimitri Petropoulos. I'm also in Tucson, Arizona, and it is sunny. And actually, you're going to be, I think, warmer than we are today. So that's pretty amazing. One awesome is that the wildflowers continued to explode in different stages. So now we're at a different state, different stages, different flowers. We were up on the foothills of the Catalina Mountains, which are on the north end of Tucson 2 days ago, and the explosion of yellow flowers climbing up the mountain with saguaros, yellow flower saguaros, just going up the mountain, which was just absolutely remarkable and pretty awesome. And my second awesome is a quick awesome about my eldest son, who is in the tech industry. And he was telling me a story that he had visited a client that was actually out of the country. And I asked him, well, how'd that go? Oh, yeah, we got the contract. I said, what do you mean you got the contract? He said, well, they were interviewing a whole bunch of other people, and we came in and offered our services, and but we weren't able to actually make it work to their specification. They were so impressed with how much time he took, to just do everything possible to make it work, that they basically told them, we're going with you guys because it was obvious you wanted to make it work. It wasn't like, moving on to the next client. No, you did everything you possibly could do. So that was pretty awesome to hear that. And, you get to be the proud parent for a while and you go, yes.
I love it. So Carl is privately musing that you are amazingly magical, Dimitri, that you can be heard when your microphone is off.
It's a thing called telepathy, and I have to do it to the entire world.
Yeah, don't ever show what's behind the curtain.
I'm pulling those levers, or levers.
And Jane just let us know that her camera is she may need to reboot, but she'll definitely be back. There are so many awesomes happening both personally and creating the future, that I don't even know where to start. I've been, one of the big things that we are working on this year is finding partners who want to help us scale, as we've been talking about the restructuring and redesign of this organization so that it scales our mission. Also talking about partners who want to work with us and help not just fund but be part of scaling this thing as we're building it. And I've just been having some of the most energizing conversations with people in the capacity building realm from all different places, both foundations and people doing capacity building and organizations I never even knew existed that are looking at capacity building in different ways. And so that's been really exciting to start having a conversation about what would capacity building look like if it were focused more on ends than on means, or focused at least on ends as the context of means, rather than just looking at capacity building being about all of the internal stuff, making the assumption you'll then know how to go out and change the world. And so those have been just energizing conversations, having conversations with folks to say, can you imagine, right now you go in to learn how to, I'm in college and I want to learn how to change the world. You either go into the social sciences, political science and sociology, or you go into social enterprise and nonprofit management, all of which teach you the means, without really any focus on what does it take to create ends. And having conversations to say things like, can you imagine if the first two semesters in a nonprofit management, not even calling it that course, all you learned was about social movements and what made social movements work and what made them not work and it's just so exciting to think about. So those are some of the massively geeky conversations that I am getting to have 2 and 3 times a day, all day long, with folks. And so it's just, from a very geeky perspective, it's very fun. So that's what's been awesome around here. I hope Jane can join us. She's been having trouble with her Zoom, and I don't know if it's, Dimitri, do you want to see if maybe there's a way that we can send her her own link, because she's been trying to use mine, and maybe that's what's, I don't know.
Also, I was going to suggest to her the updating her Zoom client.
If you'll deal with that, that would be.
Yeah, I'm gonna step out for just a second and call her.
Okay.
I think that'd be the easiest.
That sounds like a plan. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Now he's mute and.
You can still hear me.
uh, Yeah, he's just here for the entertainment value, Carl. That's really all it is. So to bring us back up to speed, we have been diving into the nuts and bolts of what it will be to start the board part of this organizational redesign that we've been talking about for many months and years. And last time we had a phenomenal conversation about really asking, you know, if we're compliant, and compliance really is about expectations, then whom are we compliant to, and whose expectations are we really talking about? Who are we making commitments to? And we came up with a long list, and we came up with the kinds of things those people would expect. And so that really is, as we think about catalytic thinking, the first place that we start is listening, is naming who are the people that'll be impacted. And if we cannot have the conversation with them directly right at that moment, we have had many conversations with many of those individuals. And so we have a sense of what we would be listening to if we were listening to them. And we will have individual conversations in the future. But for right now, we can easily say, for instance, if there's expectations of the federal and state law, if there's expectations of people who are investing in our mission in various ways, what do they expect? And we've had so many of those conversations over time that we came up with quite a list. What we'll do now is ask, if we met those expectations, what would that make possible? What is the high potential outcome of all of that? And so that being the next question, I was sort of smiling as we were having our conversation about credit cards, that it led to internal financial controls, which leads right into the first group of people that we were talking about meeting the expectations of, which is state and federal law. In this particular case, the IRS. What does it make possible if we are, we had said that the expectations of the IRS is that we will file the 990, comply with their rules, evidence that our activities fit with the exempt purpose. For the state, again, annual filings, have minimum board members, and complying with all legal obligations. If we are complying with everything that the IRS and that the state want of us, what does that make possible? And I'm really loving the thought of the internal controls on that. What does it make possible if we are in compliance? What is that really talking about?
Well, if I can kick off, I guess an obvious starting point for me is that if all the hygiene factors are taken care of, that means we can actually focus on the things that we are really here for, mm-hmm. Where we want to sort of change the world. I am sort of minded that one of the things that we keep talking about at my work is about trustees. And we sort of quite often say, well, nobody ever decides to become the trustee of a nonprofit or a charity. They join that, or they get involved in that nonprofit and so on, because they believe in the cause. There's something that they want to change the world. And then you end up being a trustee doing all this IRS regulation type stuff, because, you know, I mean, that's just got to be done. So in a perfect world, we would do those things as quickly as possible, and we would do them well, so that we can focus on what we really came together to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. In my mind, it speaks to, it encourages us to have systems so that stuff happens like clockwork. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, just one other thing. An expression that I've been using sometimes at work when we talk about this stuff, and you know, I mean, this is almost sort of what the sort of thing that creating the future sort of might do, is it's almost, and if you'll excuse the language because I haven't quite got this right, we will help you run your business so that you can instead focus on running your organization. If that makes sense. So we'll try and help you do all those things that nobody really wants to do. Governance, financial stability, and so on, so that you can focus on the things that actually you have some real insight on because you have user experience and so on, i.e. the mission of the organization.
Right. Yep. Yeah. What else do you all see it makes possible if we are filing, complying with the rules, evidencing that our activities are matching and meeting expectations of the legal authorities?
One thing it does is it it minimizes the opportunity of someone hijacking the organization's work. You know, I think we often find people who will get sort of, you know, stuck in that minutia of compliance and then try and take down an organization based on that, or, you know, engage in trying to minimize the impact of an organization through those mechanisms, basically saying, you're not in compliance, so you don't deserve to be. So, you know, if all those T's are crossed and I's are dotted, it just eliminates that possibility of it being a distraction, and at worst case, it being a lever for someone to use to undermine us on grounds that are not the true values, outcomes grounds, which absolutely they would have reason to engage with us around. But the other ones, if we can eliminate those, it's just one less thing.
Right. Yeah. It bulletproofs us. And I to me, there's and I know it's fresh in my mind because we were alluding to it when we were talking earlier. But there's a hole in it, and it really has so much to do with what you were talking about, Carl, in terms of if we've got controls that make it easy to comply with those external expectations, they will also protect us. So it's both. It's meeting the external expectation and at the same time doing exactly what you're talking about, Justin, that it does protect.
And I guess I would frame it as it provides a strong foundational pillar as opposed to a weak one. So when we're not in compliance, we have the opportunity of that pillar being knocked out from under us and taking out the rest of the good work with it.
Yeah.
So by having compliance there, we're solidifying that, which minimizes the risk of, you know, a compliance problem undermining the other work of the organization.
Yeah, we are familiar with an organization that was clocking along, and never realized that they had a provisional approval from the IRS and had never made that the final seal, and were operating as if they had their tax exemption and they had lost it. And didn't even know it. That's big. That's big. The other IRS thing that I'm thinking about, in my old consulting days when I used to consult on governance and I used to talk to boards and I would ask them to guess what errors and omissions and directors and officers insurance, what the most claims were for nonprofits, and they would all say fraud, and they would say, you know, all kinds of embezzlement and stuff, failure to pay payroll taxes. So if there was one thing that individual officers were frequently brought up on that wasn't covered by insurance, failure to pay payroll taxes is the highest one up there. And I think, again, being compliant, it takes away that threat that could happen. and putting in controls and systems to make sure. So for instance, our payroll all goes through a third-party payroll company. So it's not dependent on, you know, if we happen to be in town and we happen to file it and somebody else. So I really like the thought of that pillar being strong, Justin, in terms of, because it is so easy for something that you're not thinking about, as you said, Carl, it's not the stuff you want to do. And it's easy for that stuff to get, oh yeah, I got to deal with that. And making sure that's strong.
Sorry, Angie. Just very quickly, you just sort of reminded me that when we see organizations go wrong, so many times you can trace it back to poor quality governance at the beginning. I mean, I keep coming across organizations with only two or three trustees. And then, I mean, not only is the governance, and then if you have these habits and procedures and they're not in good order, they then, as you say, they lead to bad habits elsewhere. Sorry, Angie.
Yeah.
Good point. And I was going to just connect back to our previous board meeting where we had discussed some of the importance of employees and feeling safe and secure and those kinds of, having those mechanisms in place, making sure we're paying payroll tax and other things that they, you know, that affects people who are working for the organization and so on. So it's important to have those in place. And then I think also it gives a certain amount of assurance to partners, you know, that you're not going to be, that you're going to be around, you can take care of the basics, you know, and you're not going to, you know, your pillar's not going to be deteriorating. And that side that interrupts maybe the work that's going on with the partner, the other side.
Yeah. And I think it really does come back to that very, very first thing that you had said, Carl, that if all of those things are in place, that we then have the luxury to focus on the mission.
Back to that very, very first thing that you had said, Carl, that if all of those things are in place.
Well, we've got at least a picture of Jane. We're getting closer. We're getting closer. Oh. So let's talk about the expectations of the individuals who are investing in our mission. So whether that is, we had said volunteers, financial supporters, resource donors of any kind. We talked about their expectations being a lot about accountability, showing accountability to the communities that we serve, that we're sharing power with those who receive the benefit of our work. They expect to be able to trust us, that we'll connect with them as individuals, that we will be open and transparent and honest. Evidence that we said that we were doing what we said we were going to do. If we are accountable in that way to the people who are investing in our mission, what does that make possible?
Can you say that one more time, please?
Yep, I'm happy to. It's a big one. And actually what I'll do is I'm going to bring the list up on the screen. I think that might be. Let's see where we were. So what we said was that individuals investing in our mission, the expectations that they would have as volunteers, financial supporters, etc., is that they would expect that we're showing them that we're doing what we said we would do, that we are accountable to the communities that we're serving, to the people that we are serving, that we're sharing power, and that they can trust us. And as you look down that list, what does that make possible for our mission, for accomplishing our mission, if we meet those expectations?
Mm-hmm. hopefully we meet the mission of the organization.
Hildy, I think the expression I think I would use is one that I think you have used many, many times before, which is this idea that we are throwing stones into sort of pools of water, and that actually the splash that the stone makes is not to the impact, it's the ripple. And if we want the change that we do to sort of ripple outwards, then people have got to trust us. So they've got to sort of look at us and see what else they do. I think the second thing that I would say is, and I'm just going to try and find it here. I've just been helping my wife sort of with a project that she's on. It's actually about creativity, but I read a paper about leadership and storytelling and creativity. And it's not exactly anything sort of new or original, but it very much sort of emphasized that leaders have to tell stories to sort of their followers if they want them to do things and change things. And in telling those stories have to be authentic. Mm-hmm. And if those stories are along the lines of do as I say, not do as I do, then people will not follow. Those leaders won't be authentic. So we as leaders can't achieve our mission if we are not authentic and work in the ways that we would expect people to do. So I'm sort of slightly almost going to disagree with you about how will this help us deliver our mission, because this is our mission. Behaving and acting in this way and modeling it is our mission.
Oh, I love you, Carl. It is our mission. Yeah, it's wonderful. It's perfect. It's perfect.
I also think you are getting closer to, or you are fostering and hopefully encouraging true engagement, where people feel a sense of efficacy with their action. So, you know, these are people who are investing, you know, we've talked about it, it's time, it's finance, it's, you know, whatever it is. I think, the key piece to that engagement, and I know we talked about it before, is I feel like what I'm doing is actually making a difference. It's shaping the direction. It is, you know, so I think what this makes possible is when people have this, they are more likely to engage. They are more likely to contribute to shaping what success needs to look like for the organization. And I think that, I guess just to echo or repeat or plagiarize Carl, that we are, we're practicing engagement. We're allowing the power to be shared. We're allowing people to influence and have a sense of efficacy of their contribution.
What's striking me as each of you is talking about, and I'm looking at this list, and honesty and transparency and openness, and thinking about the ripples, and I'm thinking about the fact that when we were in the executive session, which I think is the first closed session we've had, I can't remember our having a closed session, so it's got to be forever ago. That the first thought we had was about, oh, this is something for us to talk about publicly. That we are, it is modeling, it is showing, is exactly what Carl was saying. It is showing that it is possible to talk about these things publicly. And are you guys okay if I stop the share? You sort of got the list? Okay. One of the things that's coming up shortly, in future strategy meetings that will be held openly again, is a conversation around our communication strategy and PR and engaging more people because more people have heard of us. So if we're starting to engage people around this whole issue of capacity building, as I was talking, it would be nice if when we send out an email, they say, oh, we've actually heard that you're doing something. And so we're going to start having those conversations. And what's exciting in talking to the PR person that we've been talking with is that we will have that conversation openly, because it proves you can have these conversations openly, that we don't have to hide everything behind closed doors. And so I'm really loving what you all are saying, the combination of the walking of the talk and that this is our mission, is to walk the talk and to show that you can walk the talk. There's just something there that just feels very integrated, that feels very, very us. Just the whole fact that we do have our meetings openly, that we do invite anybody who wants to sit in the room, and I wish Jane could be in the room with us, proves that you can. So the whole bit of our mission piece, Carl, that you were talking about, that this is our mission, proving that you can ask a different question and ask the why not. Why wouldn't we have this openly?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts come to mind on things we've talked about. One is trust. And the other word that relates to that is expectation. And I think about it in terms of relationships with people. You have a relationship with your parents, you have a relationship with your children, you have a relationship with your friends. And part of what makes those relationships, I'm not going to make judgments, but good or bad, is trust and expectation. I expect my parents to behave a certain way. I expect my friends to behave a certain way. And that gives me trust. That gives me confidence that when I engage with them, that will happen. And so it really is, to me, the key to this component is creating that reliability of expectation and trust on all of the items that you had up on the list there, Colby, earlier, is I know I can expect this. I know I can trust this will happen. I know that this is a safe place because it's not going to hit me with something out of the blue. And so that's sort of the overview of what comes to my mind as I think about all of this.
Yeah. You know, and Angie, you mentioned partners, future partners, and I'm thinking about the participants in our programs, and I'm thinking about it's all in very, very much the same answer. And I think it really, the whole thing of the ripples and the engagement, that the more we are meeting those expectations, the more people will want to engage. And you know, to your point, Justin, the thing that I was thinking as you were talking is that it also, meeting those expectations can turn engagement into deeper engagement.
Well, in that deeper engagement, I think, so we think about creating the future, we are a collection of intermediaries. I mean, we are taking a body of knowledge, an approach, a strategy, a support network, and we're then turning that and applying it outward into the communities. And I think, you know, this classification of people, the individuals who invest in us, are investing in a return on what they can do to affect their communities and benefit their communities. So I do think that engagement is also the heart of the accountability, that, you know, these are the people that, when we meet these expectations by showing them evidence or failing to show evidence or have, you know, that when they're engaged, they're the ones who will call BS. They're the ones that will force us to be dynamic, to adjust models, to prevent us from sort of running into, you know, because, you know, these elements that are in this list, you really point to, is this doing what I think it's doing? I put something in it, and the whole series of return on what that investment is going to be complex and different for different people. But this group of people, this is our constituency. This is our group of direct beneficiaries who have the power to say, this is working or this is not working. And to hold, you know, to hold that space of accountability.
What that's sparking for me is the learning piece. That degree of engagement allows us to keep growing and learning. So by our meeting those expectations, and especially the, I see the openness, not transparency, because we're so beyond transparent. The openness as a big part of sharing power, and to me, that opportunity for learning is huge. The more people that we invite to be part of a conversation about anything, and that they have the power to make decisions, which is what we're talking about. We're talking about local decisions and a networked platform. That feeds back into all of us learning together. There's something there about learning, and I'm not being very articulate about it.
You know, a thought that comes to my mind is the idea of, you know, who's the keeper of the faith, so to speak. And when you have traditionally the board is responsible for, you know, keeping the faith of the mission, keeping the faith of the organization, whatever. And the comment that you made, Justin, about being held accountable by others who notice that we've strayed, you know, or the organization history. So basically it broadens that sphere of who keeps the faith for the organization. Because it's open, it extends that to many more people than just the board members or just the staff or just the members. So it is really part of turning it into a movement, because in a movement, it's not just the leader who does that. It's everyone within the movement has some responsibility in that, and depending on how engaged they are, how involved they are.
Well, and I think that this is a space where, along those lines, Dimitri, if this piece is successful, it frees up those obligations off the board. So, you know, because generally, you know, my high horse moment, boards are pretty much piss poor at doing what you described, Dimitri, because of whom we have on the boards. They don't have truly enough understanding to really get the efficacy of the work of the organization in many instances, and are not particularly good at being able to make that judgment as to whether the work really is in line with outcomes that they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, to me that goes beyond because of who we have on the board. It's in my mind, it's a structural thing, it's a systems thing, that we've created an expectation that they would have that knowledge. And it's such a rare group that does. And the flip side of that, which we've all heard because we've all been in these positions for way too long, is when they do have that knowledge, they all get accused of micromanaging. So, yeah. What else? So what I'm almost sensing from what we're talking about is that if we meet the expectations of, I guess where I'm going is there's the legal expectations, there's the people who legally have a hold on us, and then there's the people who voluntarily have expectations of us, which is everybody else. People who participate in our programs, people who work with us, for us, partners, people who are investing, that if we meet those expectations, we're actually being the mission, which is where you were going, Carl, in the first place. That if we meet those expectations, the mission isn't just something we do, that we're actually being that mission. And that models, again, who we are out into the world.
Yes, and again, having sort of lived through 4 or 5 years here in the UK, where nonprofits and charities have, in some cases, spectacularly failed to live up to people's expectations, I feel very conscious that we need to distinguish between, I guess, the sort of the statutory minimums that the IRS requires versus people's sort of values. And to go back to those words that Dimitri used just before about trust, what the IRS sort of requirements do is that they're about sort of trying to establish a relationship based upon confidence. I mean, you are required to do this because a regulator or a public authority is saying you will do that, and I'm confident in you as a nonprofit because essentially you've got to do something that you're compelled to do. But we don't want people to be confident in us. We want people to trust us, and they trust us based upon shared values and that sense that we don't just deliver great outcomes, but the way that we deliver those outcomes fits with how people want to do things. So to sort of give a very sort of crass, say, example, and something that I see every now and then is, we save animals, or we do this, that, or the other. That's really, really important. But you know, we're not an environmental organization, so I'm not going to worry about whether or not we leave the lights on in the evening, or whether or not we are prepared to sort of use some of our investment portfolio to put PV panels on the roof and so on. Because you come across this attitude sometimes that because I'm saving the world or I'm changing the world in this direction, therefore it doesn't matter that my board is undiverse and doesn't deliberately go out to sort of try and recruit people of color who may actually not have had an opportunity, or that I'm screwing the planet or sort of stuff like that. We've got to fit with people's values, and this is what this is about. It's about us living those values so that people trust us. They're not just confident that we'll deliver good outcomes. If I may say one final thing, if I go back to something I said at the very beginning about Danny Sriskandaraja and what he said about Oxfam, you know, Oxfam have been through a really bad time in the UK because people looked at how they operated and they had some bad problems in terms of safeguarding. And people looked at an organisation that, yes, it delivered great outcomes, but it didn't do it in a way that fitted with their values. So that's where we are as a sector. We're in a world now where how you do things is just as important as what you achieve. And that's what Danny talked about in his speech.
Well, and we're having the same issue here in the States with the Southern Poverty Law Center, of, you know, an organization where internally their practices and the management practices did not bode well with the community with regard to the kind of work they were trying to do for equity and power. And so I think, I guess there's something, just as Dimitri and Carl were starting to talk about that, this and Hilde, your comment, I think part of what we're starting to see is the differentiation of, or begging that question, well, what would it take to meet those expectations, and where best does that lie? And I think we're dancing around a lot of this does not lie in that structure that we've called the board. I mean, in some ways, we're allowing for sort of shedding some of those pieces off, because again, you know, sort of compliance is the minimum structural element that you need, but it serves it does not serve at all as a healthy proxy for actual community change or community benefit. Yeah. So I can be in full compliance with everything, fully legal, and still not be accomplishing anything. So to judge my success based on being compliant is incredibly short-sighted. Now you can, I think what Carl was raising is your success can be tarnished by a failure to comply with not only the legal elements, but also some societal norms or expectations around, you know, systems or structures that are there. But I think what's really important there is, you know, the one level of that board is a compliance body is making sure that that fundamental pillar is strong, and then recognizing that that really is just a check mark. It's like, okay, we just need, you know, that's a bare minimum that we have to have to stand on. Now, the rest of the compliance and expectation setting or expectation meeting, that's what we need to look to, in essence, outsource, where the body of the board is simply saying, is compliance with those expectations happening? Not, we are responsible for making sure that that is in compliance. So again, I think that really does, you know, beg that question that Dimitri was talking about of, you know, who best knows whether what we do actually works? Well, a compliance board should be ensuring that somewhere within the organization there is a system and structure that is transparent, that demonstrates where the expectations are being articulated, and that people who are best positioned to evaluate whether those expectations are being met, you know, that's in place.
Yes.
That's there.
Yeah.
And so there's still the responsibility for ensuring that it happens. They just are not the actors of doing it, because again, you know, in the States, the list of things that we ask a board to do is ridiculous. I mean, it's like no entity has that breadth of competency. It just does, you know, especially if our ideal board size is, you know, 7 to 12 people. Like, no, like you need more capacity to be able to do this work. Yeah. And so rather than trying to shove it into the board, we think about the board as the facilitator of that capacity sort of happening.
Could I just very briefly build upon what Justin has just said? I'd say it's worse than that, Justin, because the direction that you have just described leads you to recruit a certain type of board member who is professional, probably educated with a college degree, and if I may, probably more likely to be a white man. This sort of approach is potentially stopping us from recruiting people who, to use a popular phrase in the UK at the moment, have lived experience, who can talk directly about what the mission of that organization is. And of course, as we've discussed on this board before, you end up in conversations in the board that are just about compliance and they're not about the mission. And then you sort of forget sometimes why the hell you're here. And then you get to these absurd situations like I've heard before, which is, well, at the start of our board meeting, we are going to have a mission minute. I mean, what the fuck? You know what I mean? 1 minute at the beginning to talk about the mission because you're spending the other 99% complying with a bloody IRS or whatever. So, Sorry for swearing, everyone, if you're listening.
We all approve.
Yes. You're hoping for a bloody this or...
We all approve. I have been just like feverishly scribbling in notes and thoughts. You guys are sparking so much for me. First of all, just in terms of the compliance of ensuring that we're ticking the boxes versus the thought that the board actually has to do it. In the olden days when I was consulting and talking to boards a lot, I would ask, you know, about the employee manual, because personnel is a big thing that boards are supposedly in charge of. And they would say, oh yeah, we've got a personnel committee. And I would ask them, how many of you are personnel experts? How many of you feel comfortable standing in front of a judge, because that's how this is going to end if you guys have a personnel committee and you're all about compliance and a place where employees can go? How many of you feel comfortable standing in front of a judge and quoting employee law? And where's your employee manual come from? Well, I got it from work and I Xeroxed it. And is it current? And do you know? And the answer is, you don't have to do it. You don't have to have a personnel committee. You just have to know that it has been done. Has an expert looked at it? Has it been updated? Oh, yes. Okay. We can tick that box. Do we have a letter from a personnel company saying, an HR company saying that they've done? Yes. Okay. We can tick that box. The thought that popped for me as we were talking about the walking the talk piece, and Carl, all that you were saying about the expectation of meeting people's values, and that it's not just that you do the work, but how you do the work. The thought that occurred to me is, when we fail to walk that talk, we're actually proving that everything we say we're about doesn't work. I'm thinking about a domestic violence shelter here locally that the board was so abusive to the staff that the staff wound up unionizing. It's a domestic violence organization. And if that's how you're treating people, what you're saying by your failure to walk the talk is, everything we're saying actually doesn't work in practice, because even we can't practice it. And I think for an organization that is so about values and so about what brings out the best in people, if we fail to, it's really looking at it in the negative. If we fail to walk the talk, you know, the quote of the Pollyanna principles is being the change you want to see means walking the talk of your values. The flip side of that is, if we don't walk the talk of our values, we're actually proving that everything we talk about doesn't work. I think there's something really huge there.
Well, and I think it is sort of the ultimate in themizing and victimizing, which is basically saying, well, for you, it needs to be this way because you are less than, different than,
not as smart, not as
not as good as, but for me, it works fine to be this way. And yeah, I mean, I think it just, it continues to reinforce what you were saying, Carl, of, you know, we recreate a system of privilege and isolation and myopic thinking, yeah, that's often divorced from the reality of what's going on. And I appreciate what you're saying, Hildy, of, you know, if you can't practice it, you certainly shouldn't be preaching it. Yeah. As the basis of your organization. Sorry, Jane, I saw you had it.
No, Jane.
I'm on a laptop. Apparently, Zoom needs to upgrade for the latest Mac operating systems. I love what Carl said. That's a big topic here as well, about the lived experience being needed, not just professionals. I've challenged people who wrote about the marvelous evolution of boards from community people to professionals and said, no, that's the wrong direction, although I like a mix. And Hildy, I've had so many of those personnel manual conversations. It's just become a norm. But Justin, I'm not with following you, and that may be because I've been out of touch with this, but Hildy knows I'm a skeptic. I'd say that most of the organizations I deal with, a board of 7 to 12, is more than the staff and more than the volunteer group that sees itself as having any role in ownership, whatever. If we ask them to do all of it, and yes, I fully agree we shouldn't spend board time on how to comply, just if we, yep, move on. If we don't have that group actually talking about, you know, what's happening in the community and what do we need to do about it, the staff hasn't got that skill either, and they have even less breadth of lived experience and knowledge in most of the organizations I'm dealing with. If the board wasn't doing it, there's nobody. Or you have, you know, in some cases, you have a marvelous enough executive director who'll make it happen. But if the executive director's less than marvelous,
well, and again,
those conversations take place. If you free up the board from the personnel manual crap, because I talked them into a one-page oversight policy instead for HR, and say, you don't even need to see the rest of the manual. You just need to know it exists. And once a year, has it been reviewed and updated if employment law changed? Well, this does not take a long time in board meetings. You can use them effectively.
Right.
Well, I don't know how the smaller organizations would do it otherwise. Creating the future has an engaged international community, but...
Well, and that's what we're talking about. And so I want to make sure that we don't get too far afield into how boards suck, because that could be all day, every day. But really...
Well, Justin did, though. He talked about how piss poor they are, and I'm not disagreeing with that.
Yep.
Trust me, I'm not disagreeing.
Oh, I know. One of the other... things that I'm seeing that this makes possible. If we are meeting the expectations of all of those individuals who are investing in our mission in whatever ways, including participating in programs and partnering with us, I see all of those as really investments in what we are about. And if we're building this as a networked platform where decisions using catalytic thinking are being made by the people who are actually in the trenches doing the work, and we're creating sort of a central hub that is all around making sure they have what they need, and a big piece of what they need is to make sure that we're meeting expectations of others and that we are compliant with those expectations. The thing that I have found about boards in general is that we dance around the fact that supposedly the boards are in charge, because if you look at standard hierarchical org chart, they're at the top. And then everybody says, yeah, but no, really, the CEO is in charge. And what I have found in many, 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 many organizations, I dare say most, is that what's actually in charge is fear. And it's everybody's fears, and it's scarcity fears, and it is... So the CEO is in fear of whatever, and the board is afraid that they don't know their job or do. And if what we're looking at is what it makes possible to be intentionally meeting those expectations of engaging and building trust and walking the talk of those values, you don't wind up so much with fear running the organization. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've heard, yeah, those are our values, but right now our values have to be that we need the money. which is what you were talking about before, Carl, in terms of, yeah, we're an environmental group, but yeah, we're not going to keep the lights, you know, we're going to keep the light switch on, because the situational ethics, I guess, is where I'm going, of you're either walking the talk of your values or you're not. And I think that that's a really big piece for us, especially if our whole focus is, what does it take to bring out the best in people? Yeah, Carl, go ahead.
I don't know if I'm taking this in a different direction, but you know, I mean, I have a messy mind. The first thing that sort of occurs to me is this: is that in that sort of conversation about expectations, a lot of this seems to be rooted in this idea that our stakeholders don't understand us and they want to know more about us and what we're doing, so that in order to meet their expectations, we have to help them understand us. And the big problem in all of this is that they don't understand us as an organization. And one of the things that I've talked to people about here in the past, and someone said this to me once, I don't lay claim for originality, is that the problem isn't that the public and our stakeholders don't understand us as nonprofits. Quite frequently, the problem is that us as nonprofits don't understand the stakeholders. So in that, and I think Justin was sort of talking about this before, about expectations, is that I think quite frequently we're so focused upon ourselves because we think that we are the center of the universe, that we're so upset that we're not thinking enough about actually what is it that people want. And for example, when it comes to impact, a lot of the time, I mean, there's an obsession with, and you know, when you have this in the US with I won't name them, but some of the sort of the infrastructure type things that obsess on measuring impact, and most people don't give a shit. They care about stories. They care about how they make you feel. So that's my first observation. My second observation, and this really is shakier stuff, it's your point about fear. I wonder if a lot of this fear is rooted in leadership approaches, techniques that broadly speaking are borrowed from business, and they're very male oriented. You know what I mean? They're about, you've got to be competitive and you've got to understand who else is sort of in the field and doing this, that and the other and so on. And again, coming back to Danny, who, you know, I mean, clearly has had an influence upon me. Danny talked about how the fact that in the future, civil society needs to incorporate much more feminist leadership principles that are much more collaborative, that are perhaps a bit more informal, that are a bit more discursive, that are a bit more about recognizing that we're faced by complexity and that we don't always know where we're going. So I guess that's my other observation. I don't quite know, I haven't read enough yet to understand what those feminist leadership principles might be, but it strikes me that's more the sort of thinking that I think you're taking us in the direction of, Hildy.
Yeah. And building, what's exciting about what we're building is that it really is building collaboration and building relationship, even beyond collaboration, building relationship into the DNA of everything that we do. Yeah. Justin, go ahead.
Where was I going to go? So I think, I mean, taking it back to our original question of what a compliance board makes possible, I think, Jane, this goes a little bit to your question, and I agree with you, if not there, where, sort of question, but I think that's part of where we're going. If we have an entity that is responsible for that compliance piece, then it frees up other people to pay more attention to these other higher priority expectations being met around, you know, and it's a whole range of things. Some of it can be, you know, internal operating systems that are efficient, you know, that it's not always, you know, the sort of sexy, you know, are we changing the world questions, that we have people who are systems people, and really the benefit that they provide is to be able to, you know, help us get the internals going. But the idea being that if the board is just primarily this compliance entity, which is, doing some of what you're talking about, Jane, which is making sure that the boxes get checked, making sure that there are people actually paying attention to. What it does is it, one, if we only have the 8 people, we might actually be able to free up 6 of them to do sort of some of that heavy lifting capacity that the organization might need, that they may not have been doing because of the machinations of being a board that was trying to do sort of a whole lot of stuff, just not very well. And so what I see is actually an ability to compartmentalize things a little bit better. That when we have a compliance board, we're going to ensure that there's a small group of people making sure that the questions are being asked and answered. But then the process of asking and answering the questions, we can then look at the other source that may be a better source for that piece of information. Just in the same way that you would say, let's have a HR attorney look at our policy. Okay, let's have community members really tell us what successful outcomes look like and whether or not our system and approach helps them get to that. Let's have the people who really understand process and theory of change that could actually help us better understand how we talk about ourselves to the community. Some of your point, Carl, about like, it's not that the community doesn't know us, it's that we can't seem to talk about ourselves in a productive way. Again, what's that?
Would you say that's really helpful? Because I can see how the two different groups appeal to different people to be part of. The accountants that get antsy every time we talk about the community and change and new ways of thinking. Like, I've got 3 accountants on my current charity board, and you can see them going, should we get back to the finances?
And then everybody else, as soon as you get on finance, they go, can we get that away from finance?
And most community people that we try to bring on don't want to have to learn things like how to read audited financial statements. Right. So we discourage people, especially if English is a second language or, war in their country interrupted their education or whatever, then they don't feel comfortable in that kind of environment, especially not challenging the accountants if there's something doesn't make sense, like, why are we not giving any money to our top priority kind of discussions, which need to happen because the accountants often don't give any money to the top priority in the budgets they put forward. I can see Carl laughing. He's been there. I guess as well, it would be a big benefit in many places to not have the, boards aren't supposed to micromanage, therefore we can't involve them in anything that we need help with, even though some of them have skills to help. If they're not the board and not the people who decide on the compensation of the CEO or that kind of thing, then that makes it a more casual relationship. And might be able to use their skills better. And I agree with Hilde, building relationship is the big thing that's happening here. And the articles I read on leadership say that's the top thing women bring, that most women bring, not all, that most men, not all, don't, to their leadership. It's the trend. As in fact, I've seen articles lately that say the biggest single trend issue now for leadership skills is level of empathy. Isn't that wonderful?
It really is. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That makes me reflect, and I have been, Carl, reflecting on your, to paraphrase, the exclusivity of the board club and who gets to be on that in that club, and how, in an unspoken way, it ends up being white males of a certain educational level. And addressing what you were just talking about, Jane, is that the lived experience is not there. The community experience is not there, or it may likely not be there with that. And by being a checkbox compliance board, yes, our financials are being properly monitored. our HR work is being properly monitored. That can be handled by anybody. It doesn't require a high level of specialization in anything to be able to make sure that that compliance is there, be it experts who are doing that. So, you know, I just keep reflecting on how it opens the potential for people to participate in an organization and allows it to be diverse, not because you went out and tried to recruit somebody of an XYZ quality, whatever that is, but because they want to participate and they feel comfortable and welcome in that, and that there is a trust relationship that they are valued for who they are, as opposed to those particular qualities that had a tendency to make boards what you described, Carl, because many boards are just that.
There was something in Dimitri, that what you just said, that I think is really interesting, which was you, in your statement, you democratized compliance. And you made it much more achievable or accessible to people to be able to say, to actually be even on a compliance board doesn't require professionalism. It requires the ability to inquire in a particular way. And you can do that. Yes. Even if English is your second language, you can feel comfortable being an agent of compliance, which, you know, again, for some, it may not be the sexiest thing in the world. For others, it might be an access to power and control that they've never had in their life, to actually be able to inquire, is this working right? Does it feel like we're in compliance? And I think that ability to, I mean, I hadn't even thought about sort of that side of this, which is, When you develop the infrastructure of a compliance board that really does scaffold people in terms of the kinds of questions they need to be asking and answers they need to be looking for, we open this up to anybody being able to ask those questions and begin to build confidence and competence in that space, which I think is then transferable to other things. But it's funny because it's not where my brain was going. My brain was actually going more towards, you had this sort of probably highly professionalized people serving as this compliance body, but you just demonstrated that no, actually, we can structure it in a way that it can actually be effective and much more democratic.
Yeah, the thought that occurred to me as Dimitri was talking is, and it fits, you just articulated so beautifully, the democratization. I love that phrase, Justin. The thought that occurred to me while you were talking, Dimitri, was that for much of the compliance stuff, you could probably write software that would ask the questions that you could tick the boxes. So my brain went to the same place as Justin, only Justin, you were so eloquent about finding words for it, that anybody could do it. That at that point, if you've got, here are the questions we want to know about the accounting, or here's the questions we want to know about HR, here's the questions we want to know, that you know, I'm sort of being extreme, but you really could have, you could have an app for that. And that allows anybody to do it, which then says you need professional people doing the do, but the monitoring of that, because it is the difference between the doing and the monitoring, the doing and the ensuring. And the ensuring could be anybody. And I love that word, Justin. Jane, yes, and then we're going to go into reflections.
The CPA organization in Canada has published a bunch of booklets that are all available for free download on 20 questions to ask about financial statements, 20 questions to ask about. So those could be put onto an app very easily because they're right there. It's a really good resource. This is, I think it's cpa.ca. that has all these marvelous books that are actually readable. They're not designed for accountants. They're not even all written by accountants, even though it's produced by the accounting body. And so that's a really good point, is if people aren't sure what to ask, okay, which of these apply to us? They won't all apply to us. Maybe we have something unique we need to do. I'm on a land trust board trying to figure out how to fund stewardship forever. It's been a very interesting accounting learning for me.
Yeah.
But, a lot of that really could be there to reassure people that what they're mostly doing is listening for whether they trust the answers.
Mm.
You know, does what they're hearing make sense? But, you know, that we've done this. This went off to the government last month, whatever. They are hearing people confidently assure them. And, of course, the external auditors and whatever eventually is back up. So that's another way to reassure the community people, is they're not on their own.
Right. And you know, the external audit can be any kind of audit. Yeah.
Yes. I've done an ethics audit once.
Yeah.
And then there's an audience we left out of that list, which was the board member. What does it make possible for the board member? And Jane, you sort of took it full circle. You might not have been on the call when Carl was talking about trust. I mean, how many boards do we have where people on the board don't know whether they trust the organization, or they don't even trust themselves, but they may not, they may be so anxious and afraid, they don't even trust whether the organization is good. Like
Or they think their job is to mistrust. I mean, how many board members believe that their job is to be the thorn in the side and the devil's advocate, and, you know, pick your metaphor, but believe that that's their job, is to poke holes and stuff.
Mm-hmm. But I think even a more insidious one is, I don't trust myself that I know enough to make a judgment as to whether or not this is a good, healthy, effective organization. And so I know I've been there, so I've been one of those board members, and I know many board members who sit there and feel that way. They feel incompetent in being able to actually engage and ask questions of the organization. And I mean, if we have board members who don't have that level of trust in themselves and trust in the organization, I mean, again, it's that mirror effect of the board members can then trust that the organization is healthy, and they can trust that they can represent the organization as healthy.
Oh man, we could talk for another 2 hours. This is getting good. And I wish we could. It is time for us to take a deep breath and think about what you are reflecting on in our conversation, what you are taking with you to ruminate on, what will percolate in the shower for you later.
I can start by saying that these discussions remind me of the discussions that we have in our field of public administration, which is an ongoing issues around the degree to which we rely on public administrators to do things versus citizens doing things. And for example, when we think about our roads and how they're designed, people's lived experience about how they get around should guide, right, how we design roads so people can get around safely no matter what they drive or whatever. But we often rely on public works engineers to design things in a way that in a worldview that they have about getting cars quickly through a city, for example, that runs up against the lived experience of people. But we tend to say to the, you know, citizens, well, you don't know enough about design road to, you know, to listen to. But you know, in reality, they know a lot about, right, how they experience things that we don't pay attention to. So thinking about our discussion today, like, I guess it's really been interesting for me to think about this in the context of at the organizational level, too, that we have a sort of similar situation where there's who's creating policy, who's implementing policy, or monitoring policy, and that there's an opportunity to get a lot more people involved if we restructure how we think about that.
Wow. Yeah, there is another whole 2 hours of conversation right there. We need to gather over alcohol someplace and have this conversation.
So I'll go next. First of all, a fantastic conversation. I've really enjoyed it. I mean, I've had a long day. I'm tired. I've got other things to do. But that was a good 2 hours. Something that when we were talking earlier on before, I was, part of me was sort of thinking, you were asking, you know, what difference does it make? What does it enable us to do? And part of me feels like answering sometimes, well, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, I mean, if we're not very good at some of this stuff, the choices that people have if they want to change the world now are so wide, they're so broad, that there is something else out there. And the biggest problem is ourselves. You know, I mean, the biggest risk is to ourselves, because people have other places that they can go to sort of change the world. But then I sort of think, no, actually, you know, I mean, whilst it might not matter at an individual organizational level, this stuff matters at a much grander societal level. Because if you believe the same as me, and I know, you know, I mean, that's a rhetorical question because I know you all do, that there's actually something really different and useful and important and valuable about the non-profit model and about coming together for the benefit of the community. If you believe that those things are right, it is incumbent upon us to get this stuff right. Because if we don't, we won't be able to show that we're different to the private sector or the public sector. And then we will lose this thing that we have. People will lose trust, not just in us as an organization, they'll lose trust in us as a model. And I think that is incredibly important, that we've got to get this right, not just for our own organization or indeed the organizations we're trying to help. We've got to get this right because the model is important.
Big, 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 big stuff.
Carl, I love that you're talking about the importance of what we're trying to do, because, yeah, there are a whole lot of other ways that people are going about changing the world. Many of them are very short term. They may actually have a great deal of impact in a short term. They don't tend to have lasting structures that keep the that have the continuity of working with the community and knowing what's changing. And often they have very little accountability. So that's why we hear about people who've collected tons of stuff for some disaster relief that wasn't needed, never got there, and can't explain what happened to the money that was donated. Yeah. Yet we're the ones losing trust of the public, and partly because they don't understand what we do. And if any of the rest of you are on Quora, I answer questions all the time, most of which are totally negative. You know, how come all charity executives are so overpaid would be a typical kind of question. But these are like every single day there's a bunch of those. Why would I donate to charity when they're all just making some people rich kind of questions? They're almost all American, I should add. It seems to be a mostly American forum. So my reflection is, anything that helps engage more people authentically in the community, people with the lived experience who have to live with the results of what we're doing, is a good thing to explore and get right.
Yeah. Sorry, just laughing. Oh, go ahead, Carl.
Sorry, I know I've had my turn, but what Jane just said is so important. We should spend 2 hours talking about what Jane just said in the last 2 minutes, because I see all the time people are obsessed at the moment in this country with social movements. They think social action and social movements are the answer to everything and that we don't need organizations anymore. And it's not true. And we have to defend why the nonprofit model is important.
Justin.
Well, I think, I guess part of what I'm reflecting on, sort of dovetailing on Carl, is a yes and, which is that we need to find the organizational structure, because, you know, organizations are the formalized way of containing this energy and supporting it and moving forward. And so we need that capacity. Part of what has happened is the manifestation of organizations currently actually isolates. And I think that's where the pendulum is to the movement, is saying, well, the organization solution doesn't work because people aren't collaborating and they're, you know, inwardly focused. And so I think, you know, it's a classic throw out the baby with the bathwater, which is, okay, we need an organizing principle. What has, you know, so we're not saying into our discussion, we're not saying we don't need boards, but we need to reorganize the structure so that it serves what we're trying to accomplish a bit better. And I think I'm, you know, for me, in terms of my reflections is, again, I have really, really strong opinions about this, which is, you know, the boards are broken and the expectations we have for what a board member does, you know, basically creates impotence in board members. And then it you know, and a lack of confidence, and then you get an overreaction of ego. And I mean, it's just, it's like, I mean, if we couldn't have created a more perfect petri dish of how sort of power misaligned expectations create just an icky, ineffective system. I mean, that's why we all say it's broken and it kind of sucks. So I like that we can look back and say, okay, we know organizations need capacity. We know they need competencies. We know they need some organizing structures. They don't need to be what we've tasked them as. And when we can sort of pare down minimal and then see where there are other options, you know, that's, you know, for me, that's really engaging. And I think, again, to Carl's point, if we can figure out this model and say, here's a way that it can work, it can address, you know, the concern that Jane raised of where does capacity come from, if not from that entity, it gets the compliance people, it gets, you know, I think that's going to be really powerful to show that you can actually do this.
But just
and the other side was just, Jane, I think it's so funny, like, so it's okay to pay millions of dollars to the person who's polluting mm-hmm. the earth and making it unhealthy to live, but to not pay the person who's cleaning it up and making it livable.
Since I'm in the environment.
Not even going to go there.
Not even going to go there. But when you said that, I was like.
Uh-huh.
But Justin, I am imagining a workshop and a conference titled Curing Director Impotence. And we'll see how it goes up.
Oh, dear God. Dear God, so long as we just don't hand out little blue pills at the door, I think we're fine. Oh, gosh. Dimitri, what's standing out to you?
The idea that a board can become an empowering, the board structure can become an empowering entity, as opposed to what Justin just described, this sort of, you know, backstabbing, you know, fear-based, reactive, and I'm obviously putting words in your mouth here, but the image that came to me when you were talking about this, and that lived experience, people with lived experience can enter a board and be empowered by it. Yeah. And consequently, the organization is empowered by this. So boards can become empowering entities as opposed to reactive, regressive entities. So that's what, you know, I'm sort of pulling out of this discussion. And really the difference between reacting and creating, because all of the short-term stuff is reacting. You know, that's not creating anything. It's just reacting to what's happening. And sometimes, wow, look, we successfully cleaned up that pond. Yes, but we didn't do anything about creating circumstances whereby that pond will be polluted again. So that's what I'm walking away with, is the really enticing idea that this can become something so positive across the entire spectrum.
Yeah. Two things are standing out to me. One is the entire powerful importance of we spent a couple of years ago talking about what do our values look like in action. We had several online conversations and inviting people to say, from what you know of creating the future, what do you think our values are? And quite honestly, it felt kind of nice to see that we were walking the talk as much as we could, that people were actually identifying the values that we would want them to identify. And so the vast importance of walking the talk of our values, of being able to articulate what those are, that our values statement on our website is a statement of our values in action. That is just really, really striking me in our conversation. The other thing that is striking me is around issues of inclusion, and I'm less articulate about that, but it's something that's sort of swimming in my head, that when we have, and Angie and I were having this conversation earlier, when we have these conversations about we need two of these and one of those on the board, because we want to have an inclusive board, the reality is that you could have 700 people on your board and still not be representative of your community, because you're not addressing everybody's lived experience. You're not addressing all of the people who, you know, because you've got one of these and two of these doesn't mean you have real representation of your community. And the importance of finding structures that are inclusive, because a board by definition just cannot be. It can sort of look maybe a little bit like, well, we have 20% of this in our community and 40% of that, so that's what our board will look like, but it's never going to be truly inclusive. It's always going to have a very, very tiny number of people compared to your community. And so there's something really big here about redefining the structures of organizations and how we think about those structures, so that systemically the entire system is inclusive, rather than making the assumption that those 5 people or 8 people or 12 people on a board are going to suddenly make us inclusive. I think that I'm loving this conversation, because it really gets to the heart of what does inclusion really mean, when we build systems to ensure that we are including people, that inclusion means participation. That inclusion means not just having a seat at the table, but being the table. And the whole issue that we brought up earlier in our last meeting about shared power. That's what inclusion means. And what does it take to build systems and structures, organizational systems and structures, that ensure that real definition of inclusion? There's something big there that's just sort of dancing in my brain right now. So deeply grateful to each and every one of you for the conversation. Wishing you could have gotten in earlier, Jane, and we will have to make sure that happens next time, because always love your input and perspectives. It is always delicious to have you here. And for any of you watching, we will see you next time. And same bat time, same bat channel. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.